This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here. You are here present at our annual children's concert for children of all ages. And we are very, very grateful to the Kiwanis Club of La Jolla for their sponsorship of this and their sponsorship of the television broadcast that will be made. My name is Stephen Chick. I am fortunate to be the music director of the La Jolla Symphony and Chorus, and this is the La Jolla Symphony you're looking at. And we're really happy to bring you this hour-long exploration of music. And tonight we'll be exploring the great Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And we'll do some playing and we'll do some talking. And by the way, at the end, we'll have some chance for questions. And so if you are listening to the music and something occurs to you that you would like to ask, remember it. And towards the end of our time, we'll have a chance to ask them. You are also listening, by the way, to our dress rehearsal. The concerts are tomorrow and on Sunday. So you'll hear us play, but you'll also hear us rehearse a little bit. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Before we do any playing with the orchestra, I'd like to hear a sound that I brought in today. I'd like you to listen to this. Could you listen very carefully? Thank you. What does that sound like? Sounds like a drum, right? It sounds like a drum. In fact, it is a drum. What you're listening to is a recording from the BBC made during the Second World War. The music that introduced the newscast to announce the D-Day invasion. Ta-ta-ta-ta. Ta-ta-ta-ta. It was the famous Morse code for V for victory, the theme of Great Britain in the Second World War to win the war. It sounds like the knock of fate. It sounds like somebody's pounding at the door. Do it again, Vanessa. Exactly. Bum, 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 bum. Chum, 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 chum. Bum, 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 bum. It's the knock of fate. Where do we get that sound from, those four notes? Those four notes are probably the most famous four notes in the history of music. They are the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. You'll hear them right now. Bum, 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 bum. And that's where it comes from. Now, why are those notes so famous? Why are those four notes that famous? Well, partly because they start a very, very famous piece. But there's something interesting about them. It moves down, right? Not up. And then it moves down again. And so it shows right at the beginning that this is a serious piece, that there's high emotion, that there's passion, that there could be even the knock of fate coming our direction. That's what that means. But almost more importantly than that, there is the piece begins, and this never really happens. The piece begins with a rest. It begins with a silence. It doesn't begin. The first note of the piece is not da 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 da. The first note of the piece is ba 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 bum. It starts with an emptiness. And with that, Beethoven makes a space. And over the next 35 minutes of the symphony, he seeks to fill that space. He fills that in. So the fact that there is this opening at the beginning drags us through this music in a very, very exciting way. But, you know, those four notes, they wouldn't really mean anything if he didn't develop them. Now, in a classical symphony, and this is a perfect example of a classical symphony, it was premiered in 1808, usually there are themes that have lots of contrast. So if this piece starts with that heavy, dramatic beginning, then the next thing that happens, the second theme of the piece, is probably something kind of light. So first of all, we're going to play the beginning one more time to hear the opening four notes, and then we're going to skip to letter A, and we'll play for you the second theme. And I think you'll see that there's a huge contrast between the heaviness and the passion of the opening and the lightness of the music that follows as contrast. So first the beginning, then the second theme.
One more time, the opening. Now let's go right to A. Two for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
we hate to stop. You get going. I only wanted to play half that, but, you know, it's impossible to stop. But can you hear how heavy and how portentous and how important that music is? And then the next thing that happens is the sweetest melody that starts in the violin and goes to the clarinet and back to the violin. Later it will be heard in the flute. And so this is music of contrast. So think of this piece like a science experiment. There are elements in the piece that are very different from each other, that are almost the opposites, the way magnets would repel each other. If they push apart the opening theme, which is so heavy, and the second theme, which is so beautiful and so light. And then think about that four-note pattern, pa-pa-pa-pa, which we will hear over and over and over, as the opposite force, as the force that attracts and connects and makes the whole thing kind of hold together, as the musical glue of the piece. And that's the excitement of this piece. There are things that want to make it spin apart into different kinds of music, but Beethoven always pulls it back into a kind of single and united statement. Now, we're going to play the entire movement for you in just a second because you don't want to hear just little examples. You need to hear what the whole, how much the whole thing builds. But before we do that, I'd like to introduce to you the orchestra. First of all, the orchestra in general. Beethoven's orchestra, as you can see, consists of strings, violins, violas, cellos, and basses, and winds. And in Beethoven's orchestra, the winds are in pairs or multiples of two. There are a couple of little twists we'll hear later on where Beethoven adds a couple of things. But the classic orchestra are pairs of flutes, pairs of oboes, pairs of clarinets. And that's what we have. Now, for those of you who are here tonight, you know that we're just before Halloween. For those of you who are watching on television, who knows when this will be aired. And so I think I should explain why we're dressed the way we're dressed. This is not a Thursday in January, and we just show up like this. But let's actually take a look at the sections. And when I introduce the section, I'd like the people who are in costume, and you know who you are, to stand. First of all, the largest of the sections, if we combine the first and second violins together, they play related material, but they play the same instrument, the violin section. First violins and second violins, the great violin section. If you're in costume of any sort, or you think you are, please stand. Whoa, excellent. Fantastic. Thank you, you can sit down now. We're having a competition right now, and by the way, you get to decide which section has the best costumes. There's a fantastic prize, a bag of baby carrots that will be given to them at the end. The violas are right here. Let's have the costumed members of the viola section stand. Excellent. And very scary. I know that there are costumes in the cellos. The cellists love to wear costumes. Let's have the costumed members of the cello section stand. Yes. Including a costumed instrument, it looks like. Even the instrument is wearing a costume. That's fantastic. I see costumes in the contrabass section. Stand up. There you are. Aha! On the bass itself. Very good, Mark. Even though there are no costumes involved in the percussionist, I am also a percussionist by training, and the king of the instruments, the percussion, must be acknowledged. So stand up, Jason. There you are. Do we have woodwind? Yes, we do. The bassoons are extremely well represented by costumes. Stand up. Beautiful. Thank you so much. And why am I not surprised? But the costumes are completely across the back row of the brass. Why am I not surprised? Let's hear the brass. Let's stand up, brass players. Thank you. Thank you. Now, judging by your applause, I know you appreciated all the costumes, but it is in fact the brass players that will get the bag of baby carrots. Let's do this. Now that we've seen the sections of the orchestra, let's play the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, this mammoth and wonderful piece that you might have heard of but perhaps never heard live. You're going to hear now the first movement in its entirety, including the repeat. I think it's important to tell to the youth of America that we take the repeats of the expositions in classical symphonies. We will be taking the repeat tonight. Actually, there is one person who should stand up. Carol, would you stand up, please? Did you hear the beautiful oboe solo in the middle of that? Absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much, Carol. Well, now you've heard the first movement in its entirety. And of course, we hear those famous four notes when they're very loud, ya-ta-ta-ta. But we hear them all the time also when they're very soft. When the melody is going on in the upper strings, sometimes the lower strings are playing very softly. Pop-pop-pop-pop. 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 Let's hear if we can find other instances in the piece where we hear those same four notes, sometimes with a rest at the beginning and oftentimes without. We're going to move now to the third movement of the piece, and we're going to play just the very beginning, and you'll hear four-note phrases all the time. It's as though the instruments are speaking to one another, and they can only use four words. It's a little bit like that. So let's listen to the beginning of the third movement of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony.
Thank you very much. Good.
Can you hear? Sometimes it's disguised, but sometimes it's so obvious. Horns, we didn't plan to do this, but can we play your moment one more time? Ya-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Nice and bright. And can you hear the four notes, just like the beginning? But now it's 20 minutes later in the piece. Here we go, right at just the horns alone. It's one of the great themes, but it's built on the same material, from the same stuff as the beginning. And so this is how Beethoven connects the piece together. In spite of the fact that these things sound different, that they want to be different from another, they seem to be pushed apart by their differences, there's something that always brings us back together. This brings us to an important point. Beethoven was a child of the late 1700s. Now, if you think back to the history of this country, in the late 1700s, we know that we had the American Revolution, right? 1776. Well, there was a democratic revolution in Europe also in 1789, the French Revolution. And Beethoven, who was born in Bonn, in what is now Germany, close enough to France to feel the winds of revolution, was, as a young man, unbelievably attracted to this idea of democracy, of new thoughts, of independent spirit. And he saved these ideas through the entirety of his life. And many people, I'm included among them, think that this piece is his democratic piece. By that I mean his commitment to the ideals of independence and the fervor of revolution that was present not only in France but in this country. So when you hear that figure, you're really hearing Beethoven making a statement about the freedom of individual people and the right for us all to be considered equal. And you'll hear that throughout. Now, let's jump ahead. I think the third movement is kind of an amazing thing. I don't remember what I said we were going to do next, but I have it written right down here. Oh, we were going to do, we're going to do 140. You know the, all right. I lost my train of thought momentarily, but I have it back. I was talking about how there are different materials all the time, how there are contrasts everywhere you look. You heard that very important, almost martial sound in the horns. Now we're going to do something really different. It involves mostly the strings. But listen to this for how contrasted it is with the music you just heard.
I'll give you two bars for nothing. This is, and we'll take all the repeats. I'll stop you with it.
Isn't that fantastic?
I said, isn't that fantastic? So let's hear for the string section and the accompanying winds. That's beautiful, beautiful. And this is what I mean. That movement starts with the whole orchestra playing together in those loud moments with the horns. And then at a certain point, it breaks apart and does something different. And that different thing is to hear individual sections, one after the other, in a kind of fugato. In other words, in a kind of imitative form where one starts and the other comes in imitating it and the other comes in. And it feels like a kind of community of musicians when that happens. And this is Beethoven's statement about how we can cooperate and collaborate and live together. Now, can I play my favorite part of the... Well, of course I can. I'm the conductor. We can do whatever we want. So I would like to play my favorite part of this piece, which is towards the end of the third movement. We have all of this raucous string playing and all of this exchange of ideas. And then there's a point at which it gets really soft. I mean, for this you're going to have to be quiet. How quiet can we be? This is going to be so quiet, and it will feature, as I've said earlier, the king of the instruments, the heartbeat, the pulse back there. And what Beethoven does is to basically draw the bow back on an arrow, pulling it back, softer, 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 making you wait, making you wait. And when you've waited longer than you think it's possible, he's going to rush with an enormous crescendo, an enormous rise, and that starts the beginning of the last movement. There's no break between the third and the fourth movements. A lot of times, or almost always in a symphony orchestra piece, there's a break between the movements. You stop and you cough and you unwrap a sucker or a cough drop or something like that. Yeah, you talk to your neighbor, you run out for a pizza, you check the score. You do whatever you do between breaks, between movements. Here, Beethoven moves from one piece to another, from one section to another, and he does it so magically with such force that this really, I have to say, we don't choose favorite parts of pieces normally, but I have to say this is mine.
It's going to be soft. Thank you.
We could barely stop. Really, it's impossible to stop. Thank you very much. Wonderful. Isn't that absolutely astonishing music? And it's astonishing for what it is, but it's even more astonishing about how long he makes you wait for it. And the longer you wait for something you really want, the sweeter it is when it arrives. Now, we have one more excerpt to play for you before we start talking and taking your questions. But what would you do? I think I know the answer to that. What would you do if you had a great idea like the one we just heard? You know, where they make you wait, he makes you wait, and then finally the satisfaction of arrival. What would you do if you had a great idea? Well, of course, you'd use it twice. And he does. He uses it twice. Now, here's something that's very special about the Fifth Symphony. I don't know if it's going to seem special to you because now we hear music which is so free form. But in the time, Beethoven's music was on the formulaic side in terms of how it dealt with construction and issues of form. And normally what happens is that you hear the first movement and you stop and you hear the second movement and the third movement. And a symphony is like four mini pieces, all separated from one another, all different from one another. And you never go back and listen to stuff from the earlier movements just because you might want to hear it again. But in the Fifth Symphony, we hear Beethoven in the middle of the last movement, winding up his thoughts towards the end of the piece, go back and refer and take a little bit out of the third movement of again. Come back, sort of skipping back to the third movement and hearing that same thing, that wind-up, so that when the theme comes back, the majestic theme comes back again in the fourth movement, it is actually introduced, just as it was the first time, with this beautiful example from the third movement. So you have this mixture of ideas. What is Beethoven saying to us? Well, again, I hope you don't think I'm reading too much into this, but when he asserts connections across big divides, when he asserts that this thing here is actually related to that thing here over there, even though they may not sound very much alike, he is creating for us a model of the way people can relate, even though they may not seem much like each other. So when you think, and by the way, I think we're all thinking it, that things couldn't get any worse between people, that there's so much anger and there's so much everything. Listen to this piece, because it is living proof that things that are quite different from one another can inhabit the same space and can actually get along very, very well by catalyzing and energizing each other. Let's hear exactly how that happens by listening to this little snippet, this little quotation of the third movement right in the midst of the fourth movement. And then we're going to listen to the piece to the end, because at the very least, after all of this talk, you deserve the satisfaction of arriving finally and gloriously in C major, just like we all hope to do someday. The pearly gates open to a C major, by the way.
Everybody good? Everybody playing the first song. Thank you.
Amazing music, right? It's amazing music. Now, we'll just have you, smoke them if you've got them. Sit there for a moment, and we're going to have some questions. You'll see two microphones. They're lit. They're being attended to by our capable assistants. Oh, yes, we have capability everywhere you look. Now, does anybody have a question? And if you have a question, please go over to the microphone and ask it so that everyone can hear. And it doesn't have to be a question for me. In fact, maybe it's better to be a question for somebody in the orchestra, if you want. Does anybody have a question? Okay, go right over to the microphone and somebody will help you. There is our first questioner.
What is ma silence?
What is ma silence? Ma is the word in Japanese for a kind of principled, peaceful silence. It is silence extracted to its essence. Maybe ma silence is the first thing we hear in the piece. By the way, I wasn't exactly expecting that question. And I hope I didn't just make that up, but no, I think it's right. Is there another question?
Was Beethoven deaf when he wrote this?
Was Beethoven deaf when he wrote this? Thank you for asking that question. And I think it's important. You know, I didn't talk about this at the beginning because there's so many other things to talk about with respect to the music. But Beethoven was well on his way to being deaf. Now, what deaf meant is not quite possible to know. Was it that he couldn't hear anything, or was it that the audio signal was so distorted he couldn't really hear particular kinds of things? There are a lot of different theories about that, and also a lot of different theories about, you know, why he became deaf. But we know this about Beethoven. In 1802 and 1803, he noticed he was losing his hearing. He had health problems his entire life and wasn't actually all that happy of a human being. He wrote a letter, which we today call the Heiligenstadt Testament, which said that he was going deaf, and that as a composer, that was the worst thing you could possibly imagine. And he thought about ending it all. He thought about ending his life. And he said he would not do that, but he would use his art to find a way to survive his problem. And so when you listen to this music, this is his way of understanding the world, a world which was increasingly soft and increasingly distorted to him. So we don't know exactly, the answer to your question, we don't know exactly how deaf Beethoven was at this point, but his hearing was not normal and he went deaf, yes. Okay, thanks. Yes, we have another question.
How do they know to do it at the exact time?
How do they know to do it at the exact time? Well, aside from the fear of public humiliation, which of course is my greatest motivator, no, the answer actually is that we all have in our hands this music. I have here, everybody's part. This is what we call a score. So everybody has their own individual parts, and I can look at everybody's parts at the same time. And so people then know what they're supposed to play, and the hand signals that I make, the conducting that I make, helps people understand when they are supposed to play it. If I do my job right, I don't get in the way, it helps them. And so we all have the same thing. And by the way, this is what Beethoven wrote. So even though I never met him, I don't think Peter ever met him, I don't think anybody meet Beethoven. No. I don't think any of us met him. But we all met him in a certain way because we all hold in our hands something that he touched, his music. And so we can go back and see what he actually wrote and what he asks us to do. And that's how we stay together. There is another. Oh, yes, we're alternating sides. How fantastic.
Why did the writer make the music fast and slow?
Why do we play the music sometimes fast and sometimes slow? Again, this is what the composer, Beethoven, has asked us to do, and he's very particular. He tells you how many beats per minute something should go, whether it should go, if it's at 60, it's one beat every second, 120, it's two beats a second, and he tells us that. Sometimes we try to go faster than he wants us to for excitement and danger, but normally we try to do what he asks. That's a good question. We're going to take a few more minutes of questions. Are we? Oh my gosh, look at everybody. It's all lined up. Step into the light.
How many instruments does it take to make the music?
That sounds like a joke setup. How many instruments does it take? One, but no. In this particular case, we have on stage, I happen to know, let me just a quick guess, 53 music stands. And so sometimes there are more than one where there's more than one person on a stand. And so we have something like 65 or 70 people on stage. That's how many it takes to play this piece. A couple of more questions.
How much practice do you usually do?
How much practice? I'm going to give this over to Peter. How much practice do you do, Peter?
It's about 6 hours a day.
Peter practices about 6 hours a day. Oh, well, he says now that that's what the whole orchestra practices together. I don't believe that. We rehearse for this piece, I'm going to guess. I should have figured this is the kind of thing I should really know, have it on my fingertips. But let's say that, for example, we've rehearsed about 7 or 8 hours together. And then you can imagine that the 65 to 70 people on stage are also practicing a couple of hours a day. So what you're hearing, plus all of their training, is hours and hours and hours of time behind this. So, yes, we practice. Is there somebody over here?
How long has most of the players played?
How long have most of the players played? Well, I think it's a little hard of a question because there are some youngsters in the group. You know, some people who are in their 20s and they have played probably nearly 20 years. And then for those of us, the aged here, I started playing when I was 4 years old and I'm 62. So that means that 58 years of my life has been used practicing or doing some kind of music. So I'll speak at least for myself. And I think most of us started as kids. Is that right? Is that right? You see the shaking of heads. Mostly everybody started as a kid and have continued throughout their entire lives. Fantastic. Great question. I can hardly wait to hear it. What is this question?
Why is that when you sing the bum 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 bum
right?
So special?
Why was it so special? Well, now that you mention it, maybe it's not. It's a really good question. And I think you're right. By itself, it's not that special. But when you put in it a piece of music and everybody gets a chance to play it and it builds up and it builds up and it builds up and finally at the end, did you hear what the last four notes were? Bum, bum, tom, ta. And so you hear it the whole way and it just feels like it sounds like your heartbeat or something like that or the knock on a door or something important. That's why I think it's special. Does that answer your question? Kind of. All right. One more from this side and one more from this side. Yes, sir.
Why do the instruments look gold?
Why do the instruments look gold? Well, we're in an endowment campaign. help us fill the thermometer there. No, what you're seeing are these beautiful, especially in the strings, beautiful wooden instruments. Does anybody have a particularly old instrument do we have, or is it mostly modern instruments that we've got? How old is your instrument? Ah, wow. Can you just hold it up? This instrument, well, first of all, look how big that thing is. Made in 1810. That instrument was made 2 years after this piece was made. That instrument has lived practically as long as this piece. That's astonishing, isn't it? So some of them are modern, and then sometimes we see string instruments that go back even much farther than that, 400 years even. The drums are all brand new, you know. we find them. One more question, and then we'll let you go on to your evening.
Why aren't you wearing a costume?
Let's play the piece again. This is my costume. I'm pretending to be a conductor. And we're so happy that you're here. Thank you for joining us. Many, many thanks to the orchestra. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.